Huh?
Right in Podbay.
Okay.
It's bigger than actually Stitcher is, so
yeah,
it's
okay.
More important than Stitcher.
Podbay.
Wasn't that the girl in Star Wars number one?
Anarkin married her, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. That's what I thought.
What?
Okay.
You're encouraging him.
Just pick it up after the countdown.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
I'm James Wygant, associate editor of the American Stamp Dealer and Collector, and you're listening to Stamp Show Here Today.
It's hard to send up. It's hard to send up.
Welcome to Stamp Show Here Today, podcast number 22. I'm sitting here with Scott, Kaz, Jeff, and I'm your host, Jessica. You can find us on Facebook at Stamp Show Here Today and on Twitter at Stamp Show HT. Tell your friends they can find us on iTunes, Stitcher, and now Podbay. So let's talk about stamps. So this week we're talking about stamp news, death of Lickin' Stick, hashtag stamp stories, Leonard Nimoy, and our expert topic of the week is number ones. So, stamp news. As I mentioned before, the Lickin' Stick is no more. Linz reports in an article entitled Say Goodbye to the Lickin' Stick U.S. Stamp by Michael Bodkey. It's a day that many stamp collectors have dreaded. There will no more be issued what is called a WAG, water-activated gum stamp. They're going to transition to PSA, pressure-sensitive adhesive. If that makes any sense.
Yes, it makes perfect sense. You have WAGs and PSAs.
So apparently the first U.S. self-adhesive post stamps was issued in 1974, which is pretty recent.
No, that's a PSA.
Oh.
Yeah, Kaz, you're gonna have to find something else to lick.
Oh, yeah. It's not lick, it's WAG.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, those 1974 PSA stamps... they were the, for those of you who don't remember them or don't know them, it's a little self-stick label Christmas stamp. And you can't even sell them for discount postage anymore because they fall off the envelopes. The adhesive is so bad that today, you know, they don't stick on anything. You need a glue stick for them to put them on.
So does that mean someday one of those on cover will be worth something if it actually stuck there?
Have you ever seen one that, I mean, I know there are some that still stick. It's just. Yeah.
They were preserved with nitrogen or something?
They discolor because of the gum.
Oh, terribly, oh. Terribly.
And they're very difficult to get off without damaging. Mm. But if you can find one that was removed properly way back in the day, you might still have
actually,
a nice white
they're
stamp.
Very difficult to remove.
That's what I said.
Or very easy to remove.
I was going
to
say
there is nothing in between. It's either they fall off the cover.
No, I'm talking about
or they're like cement.
I'm talking about back when the adhesive was good.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Then they were difficult to remove, and if you can find one that was removed way back in the day properly, then you might have a good chance of finding a used one that has good color.
So that's the first PSA stamp.
Yeah, and I guess they're not going to destroy the old Lickin' Stick stamps. They're going to let them sell out.
You mean the PSA stamps?
They're gone.
Oh, excuse me, the WAG stamps.
Yes.
Get your PSAs and your WAGs straight.
Yeah, I got my WAGs and PSAs mixed up.
Kaz is from the government. He likes acronyms.
Oh,
I don't think it's an acronym.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
Oh, that's an acronym.
I think it's a word. When they put WAG, they meant WAG. I don't give the government any more credit than they deserve.
Well, you know what WAG stands for to me. It's a wild ass guess.
Yeah. That is true.
Wow.
It's what you do when you don't know the answer on a test.
This took a turn.
Well, PSA is professional sports authenticators or authority.
Public service announcement.
Or public service announcement. Yeah, but we're in the authentication business, so.
That's our jam.
Collectors Universe does all their baseball cards under PSA.
Good for them.
So what do you guys know about the stamp what do you guys know about the stamp created 15 years later? The 25-cent Eagle and Shield self-adhesive stamp? Did that one pass the test for sticking envelopes?
Yep.
That one did, but I'm more impressed. I think it was the same year, 1974, was it? where they made the 25-cent flag stamp.
No, you not. Was not that 70, later? Or? Not 74. It's. I think it was 89.
Oh, that. Oh, that late.
80.
Okay.
No, 80.
Whatever it was.
It was in 1990 because I remember I remember buying them out of the ATM up in Seattle.
And they were vinyl. They're not on paper. They're vinyl.
What?
Yes.
Yeah, they're printed on vinyl.
Yeah, they did the 25 and cent and then they did the F stamp.
And they stick.
Same design.
And they stick forever. And they are still sticking today. And when I got mine, you soaked it. And then you just scraped the paper off the back because there was no way to damage the stamp because it was made out of vinyl. I mean, it was just incredible.
Yeah, it's a plastic stamp.
And still you couldn't get the paper off the back of the stamp with scraping it.
That's awesome.
But that's one that I like because they sold it out of First Interstate Bank. Out of their ATM machines?
Yep. I had a First Interstate Bank account way back then.
I want to find that stamp properly used on a First Interstate envelope. That, to me, would be the proper usage. That would be a cool proper usage. I have one that's a cut square that's from a First Interstate envelope because on the inside, it had a whole bunch of First Interstate logos all over the place. So that's, but I want to find one on the full envelope. Sort of like the look coil on a look envelope.
So, Kaz, you're a numbers guy. So the look and stick costs double of self-adhesive. What do you think the government would plan on doing anyway?
You mean the WAG versus the PSA?
Yeah.
Which one?
The look and stick costs double of a self-adhesive.
Okay.
What do you think the government would be planning on doing anyway?
Well, I don't know how much it costs to print a sheet of stamps. I mean, if it costs double, it's going to save some
money.
Out
here in California, we're in a drought, which means nobody has any saliva.
Oh, there you go. Stamps. There you go.
No, it's because the self-adhesives don't need the kosher.
They don't
need certification. They don't need the kosher certification. That's what I was trying to say.
Well, that's true. What about disease transmission and stuff like that via stamps?
Yeah, but that could still be kosher. I mean,
it's either licking bad stamps or talking on a payphone, getting a virus off a payphone, which don't exist anymore. Also, they're getting rid of everything so we don't go through another plague.
Okay.
It's a health service.
Well, to answer your question, the reason they cost double is because the paper to make them is only available through international channels.
Which is a joke. International channels?
Yeah. So we don't produce it in the U.S., I guess.
The paper? What do you mean?
Yeah, the paper. The water-activated paper.
Huh. Okay.
And then the printers have to wait for the paper to show up for them to print the stamps. So it slowed down production, I guess, too.
That's really... So, wait. Okay, which one is which? I know you said the self-adhesive costs less. Where's the self-adhesive paper made?
Here.
That's made here. Oh, so we're actually going back to something being made in the USA.
Yeah.
Instead of China.
Apparently.
Oh.
Well, did you... America. This is totally off the subject, but did you see the ASDA magazine where they were talking about getting the red ink... During, what was it, World War I, right? And they actually negotiated not to break the German trade embargo just so that they could get red ink for the 2-cent stamp to the United States. And government, what can you say?
Wow.
But, I mean, really, we can't make paper that will hold gum? Is that what they're saying?
Not in the U.S.,
we can't make it cheap enough, is what they're saying.
Oh, yeah, there you go.
Oh.
So the collector's reactions, what do you think those are going to be?
They're going to be saying, hey, how do I get this stamp off this envelope? To which we say,
pure citrus.
And I'll put a link of how to do that on our show notes.
We have a YouTube that has a bunch of hits.
And more than one, which is shocking.
Yes.
I swear that was like precognition, because here it was a week later after you did that, and now they stopped the lick and stick. That's going to be the only safe way to get your stamps off cover now.
Yeah, for anybody who's on, do a search on YouTube and look. The title of the video is How to Remove Self-Adhesive Stamps in 30 Seconds. And it is a 30-second video.
Although it does take a little bit longer in practice.
It's a 30-second video on a 5-minute process.
Well, yeah, actually, it's like a 30-second.
No, you gotta let you have to let it soak
a little bit. But yeah, maybe like 2 minutes or 3 minutes.
And some issues are worse than others. Some issues it'll soak in pretty quick, and other issues it won't.
Yeah,
depends on the coating of the paper and what it's stuck to.
Yeah, let's just say if you're trying to get them off of something that's a real heavy duty paper stock, like a priority envelope, it takes longer to get them off.
Well, and the other thing too is that I say that it's pure citrus, and I hold up the can and I point to it. People have to realize that pure citrus, I'm not talking about like lemon juice or anything. It's an actual marketed item. It's an air freshener.
And it's an oil, citrus oil based.
Yeah. So, but whatever they do, you need pure citrus, because I bought another one that looked like it by accident and it didn't work at all. It smelled like oranges still, but it did not remove the stamp at all.
I did find it for one of our Facebook followers that's in Australia, asked if we knew if it just any generic orange oil that was actual legitimate oil would get it off. And I told him this is the only one that we advocate, because we know it works for sure. And I provided a link to that person that's it should be in the Facebook comments on the video, to an Amazon link to buy that very specific product.
Yeah, so. There could very easily be other ones, but I don't know what they are. I mean, somewhere out there, there's, you know.
You find one that works that well, you tend to kind of stop looking at that point.
It's made to evaporate, too, because it's an air freshener. It's not made to stay.
Yeah.
Real orange oil, like the cleaner, that stuff will stick around a lot longer. I know that, so.
Okay.
I think we've beat that one.
Wow, we went from the death of lick and sticks to pure citrus again.
Death of pure citrus.
Yeah. Well, new hot seller on Amazon, apparently.
Yeah,
apparently.
So as PSUs take off.
They haven't already.
Invest in pure citrus orange air freshener. I have a funny feeling their stock is going to go up.
By 2%.
Okay, so this week in stamp collecting history. This week marks that in 1885, the U.S. Post Office offers special delivery first-class mail for the first time. So what are the first special delivery stamp promise?
Scott? What was the special delivery stamp for?
Special delivery, they promised immediate delivery once it was reached the destination post office. A messenger would be sent out to deliver it to the address.
Okay, so.
And it wouldn't really matter what time of day it was, they would go out.
So it's a carrier stamp, basically.
Yeah, except on the back end instead of the front end.
So it wouldn't necessarily guarantee you that it would get to the destination post office faster, but that it would get from the post office to the recipient faster?
That's correct. So, if it came in on the mail train at 9 o'clock at night, it would be processed and out it would go with a
9 o'clock at night minimum wage guy.
Was there some sort of reasonable delivery time cutoff window? I mean, I don't see mail being delivered at 2 a.m. unless they really did do that.
I
see a lot of 12-hour and 24-hour clocks on it. I don't know if they can't possibly, you know, get it at midnight and go knock on a person's door.
Well, I'm sure that at that time there were certain conventions where you didn't bother somebody after a certain hour.
Yeah.
My house, it was 9 o'clock. And if Jeff called, it was never.
That's true.
Yeah, I could see how that would have given rise to the rules of last pickup of mail for the day, they'd start processing it.
Yeah, I think their home deliveries would have had something to do with etiquette, and you don't disturb a family after a certain hour.
Yeah.
Although if it was a place of business, you couldn't deliver it unless the business was open anyway, I guess.
Okay. You should have told us ahead of time. We could have done some research on this.
Well, no, I figure Scott knew.
Oh, okay.
It's more fun when we guess.
Yeah. Well, special delivery.
That leads to cash corrections.
It was invented by George Special in 1885. And what they did was they tied it to the bottom of a goose flying south.
Cash corrections.
And in the summertime, they tied it to the goose going north. Better known as goose delivery up until the 1990s.
That was pre-flight airmail.
Oh, boy. You guys had way too much dessert.
Which, by the way, totally off the subject, the park over by my house had a flock of Canadian geese land at it.
Did you go get a hunting permit?
No, but we got pictures. Oh. And I'm going to take the kids over and they can pet Canadian geese.
Those suckers are so loud.
Oh, incredibly loud. And
they're
huge.
Mean.
Oh, they're big, too. Those suckers are big.
They're mean.
Yeah, they're pretty mean.
So
I've been chased by
them.
I got two kids.
If one of them gets eaten by a goose, I've got another one.
Does that mean his goose is cooked?
His goose is
cooked. Wah, wah, wah.
No. Oh, okay.
Okay. You're talking a lot for a guy that's got to leave early.
Yeah.
Okay, Stam Stories. So on a somber note, the world lost a great talent with the passing of Leonard Nimoy. USPS has created a new hashtag called #StampWorthy. I have already joined in the StampWorthy movement, so now it's your turn. We want to hear who you think is #StampWorthy, along with this hashtag, #StampStories. So where were you guys when you guys heard the news?
I was in TexPex.
Yeah.
And that was a wonderful show because, guess what? It snowed in Dallas. Everything shut down. There wasn't a whole lot to do except sit there and enjoy the
look at stamps
indoor weather.
Well, you know, we're Star Trek, Star Wars nerds here at the podcast, so you know, we immediately went out and we got all our Star Trek stamps. And Jessica, you can tell them about your Star Trek Lives.
I pulled out some Star Trek Lives convention. What do you call them? Cinderellas? Labels? Mm-hmm.
Those would be Cinderellas.
Yeah. Cinderellas. And encapsulated the crap out of them.
I thought those were really cool.
Yeah. They're from an old convention.
1976 Chicago. 76 Star Trek Chicago. Lives.
Yeah.
It was
early days.
It was actually one of the... It was the first Star Trek... The first big Star Trek convention. And then after that, they talk about, you know, they opened up all over places, like mm-hmm. Comic-Con, basically. Mm-hmm. The first Comic-Con.
That's pretty cool.
Yep. And there were six of them, and they had everybody, and then they had an extra Leonard Nimoy and, they had an extra Spock and Kirk in addition to the other people, except they were missing, who were they missing? They were missing Sulu?
Sulu.
Yeah, they didn't have a Sulu.
No
stamp.
Sulu, but Kirk twice.
Yeah. Oh, my.
Don't ask me why.
And, hello.
That was pretty good.
And then we made some covers and got them canceled on the 27th because we're stamp nerds.
What do you mean
nerds.
We? That was all you.
No, it was all three of us. We all three put it together.
A nerd whirlwind broke out in the office and we all started getting to work.
Oh, we all started tweeting.
I'm glad I wasn't here.
Yeah, it was pretty bad.
Oh, my goodness. Everyone to your stations.
We were tweeting the end sequence of Star Trek 2 to everybody.
Search for Spock.
The beginning of Search for Spock and
oh my gosh,
playing the death scene over and over again.
Oh yeah,
everybody we knew was quoting that last line that Kirk says at his funeral. Of all the souls I ever met, his was the most human. Even one of our guys that we like that we follow on Twitter and listen to a lot of his shows, Kevin Smith, used that line.
Oh yes,
on Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
And he talked about him in Hollywood Babylon, because they do a segment on Hollywood celebrities that have passed away, and they did a long segment on him in this last one.
He deserved it, too.
Yeah.
He wasn't just Star Trek. He did all kinds of other neat things, so they're celebrating that. But
He was a photographer. He took pictures of women to show them as beautiful, no matter what age or size they were. He directed 3 Men and a Baby. I didn't know that.
But yeah. his long living other than Star Trek was In Search Of, where he convinced everybody that, you know, there was Bigfoots and crop circles and stuff like that. And I always wondered whether he actually believed in the stuff or whether, you know, he was a great presenter and everything, but do you really believe that there are crop circles made by Bigfoot, you know, on Mars?
On Mars? Oh, my gosh.
Whatever. I think I have a couple of them confused together, but...
He was a poet. He wrote a book called I Am Not Spock, and then 5 years later wrote a book called I Am Spock.
And then he made a song that nobody plays because... that would be an inappropriate thing to do.
Well, he did a really, really funny music video.
He did.
Today I'm not going to do anything.
Bruno Mars.
And it was him walking around in a bathrobe and watching Priceline commercials and rolling his eyes. It is a good watch if you guys have the time to watch it on YouTube.
Yeah. Oh, no, my favorite song, Leonard Nimoy's best song, in my opinion, that nobody has ever heard of. It was in the era of the old Rankin Bass animated movies, and he did it for the first animated The Hobbit. And it's a song called Bilbo Baggins.
Yes.
And I love that song. That is so funny to hear him sing.
Okay, so rest in peace, Leonard Nimoy. You will be missed.
We better put you on a stamp soon.
Yes. Hashtag stamp worthy. You tell the USPS.
Oh, there's no question he's going to be on a stamp. I mean, that would be terrible if they didn't.
Well, I mean, you've got the other Star Trek members that have passed away, though. DeForest Kelly, Jimmy Doohan, they never got stamps. They
could do something with them, too. But, I mean, Leonard...
Oh, holding hands in heaven.
Leonard Nimoy is...
Going where no man has gone before.
He's iconic. The other ones aren't. Scotty isn't iconic. Is Scotty dead?
Oh,
yeah.
Okay, good.
He gone. All right, so updates. Cash, what corrections do you have for us today?
Well, I have no corrections, but the office here smells like manure. They manured everything outside, and it really stinks here.
Well, that's outside it stinks. It smells like orange oil.
In here it smells like oranges.
Perpetually.
Yeah, but it did remind me of a very interesting thing that I was always working on. I want to get stamps on horse manure covers.
Those smell pretty bad.
And the reason is because I'm politically incorrect. And there was this company called the Manhattan Manure Company in New York. And if you want to hear the whole story, do a search for Freakonomics. Freakonomics is in their either first or second book. They talked about the Manhattan Manure Company and how it relates to global warming. And I thought it was fascinating because this company went out of business. They couldn't dispose of enough manure to keep New York clean. And everybody just thought that the world was going to end, that the cities were going to get overwhelmed with horse manure. And what happened was, you know, in 1902 or 1903, all of a sudden everybody used cars and horse manure disappeared. And what Freakonomics says is they sort of relate it to the thing today on global warming that, you know, there's a new technology coming somewhere. The second thing is I want to thank Scott Murphy here. He gave me the coolest chicken cover for the chicken collection, the soon-to-be chicken exhibit. And so everybody who's in, what is it, hashtag chickenresearchgroup.com or whatever it is, just be aware of that. Also, last thing is I want to apologize for the last podcast that was, 8.5 hours long?
He's talking about episode 20 that was an hour and 20 minutes long. It was a double episode.
Yeah. So that's it for me.
It's good stuff, though. Just listen to it in little trips.
Hey, I think you ought to post an image of your cover on the Facebook.
Oh, you said it was cool, but what's on it?
I'm going to. Oh, it's a chicken poultry farm corner cover from 1887. One or the other.
It's got a 2 cent Colombian, so it has to be in the 1890s.
All right, okay, 1890s. And so right now I have two chicken-related covers, that one plus the other one where there's a little letter saying that I'll sell you a Brahma chicken for $1.74. And those two things, plus a nice write-up of the CSAC, which is a Citizens Advisory Committee, which basically started because of the chicken stamp, because a chicken stamp is such a political travesty tool. And then, you know, everything. So I want to make a nice one-frame exhibit talking about the chicken stamp and everything related to it.
You still need uncacheted covers, right?
And I'm still looking for uncacheted chicken stamp covers. Please, anybody out there who has any.
It sounds stupid, but that's actually, they're really hard to find. I look.
Yeah.
Every single one of them always has a chicken cachet on it every time.
Well,
so
when I get them, they will have a chicken cachet on it, but I'll put the cachet on it.
Okay, so our listener questions. Jeff got a question on our Facebook. I inherited stamps. Now what? And you crafted this really good expert answer on it.
Okay, so, yeah, we got a Facebook question from a woman, and this I'm using the answer that I gave her specifically as a generalization, but this is kind of the answer I give everybody that asks online. She said that she got a collection. She has some stuff that's really old. Everybody says they have stuff that's really old.
It's all relative.
It's a matter of perspective. It really is. But the point is, they usually don't know anything about it because they weren't the collector. Another family member was. So this is a response that I give to everybody when they ask. I believe I can make two suggestions to you. First, if you can find a local stamp show in your area, which can usually be found with a Google search, you can take your stamps to the show and get several opinions on the value of your collection. Any reputable dealer should offer this for free and without any promise of making a sale. I said that specifically because I've seen guys that will undercut hoping to buy it. So, yeah, they shouldn't be offering to buy it if you're just looking for a price. If they want to charge or make questionable offers, move on. Your first question should always be, I have stamps from these eras and these countries. Do you deal in these stamps? Many times, a dealer will take a look, even if they are not experts in a specific area or country, simply trying to make a deal or oftentimes to just be helpful. To me, it sounds like you need someone that knows their stuff in specific areas, so keep that in mind. Second, look up the American Stamp Dealers Association, or ASDA, and find a dealer listed in your area. Dealers that are members of the ASDA have to be researched and approved to become a member, and most are honest and fair. Also, the American Philatelic Society can be incredibly helpful in giving you advice on how to proceed. Whatever you choose, be sure to try and get more than one opinion before making a decision. A good dealer will make an honest suggestion to you on how to handle the sale of a collection, whether it is eBay, direct sale at a show, or a reputable auction house. I hope I was able to give you some help in pointing you in the right direction. Feel free to ask any other questions you may have. We are always here to help. So that's just kind of a general statement pointer for someone that doesn't know anything about stamps, that suddenly has a mountain of them and doesn't know what to do with them.
I got a phone call just today, a person who spoke very, very broken English. He was very hard to, and he was calling for his friend who was bad in English. So I can only imagine what his language sounded like. But he said, I have a stamp. It's from 1838. And my friend believes it is very, very valuable. And I said, well, first of all, there weren't any stamps in 1838, but, you know, can you tell me about the stamp? And he says, no, I don't have it. Hmm. And it's like, well, what am I supposed to do? You have a stamp from 1838. You don't have it in your hand. So, you know, I asked him, what does it look like? He goes, I don't know. I don't have it with me. Well, how am I supposed to answer this question? So if you do, you know, I have people email me pictures of stamps all the time and say, hey, can you look at this and tell me what it is? And I say, not a problem at all. The second thing, of course, is there weren't any stamps in 1838. So I think what he was looking at is a stamp that, like, was 1838 to
commemorative.
Commemorating something that happened in 1838. Mm-hmm. And then it turned out it wasn't an American stamp. So it's like, holy mackerel. So what, there's 127 countries out there, and I have to figure out which stamp this is?
The commemorated something
in 1838. 1838. And I'm not up to on my Latvian history or whatever. So if it's something from...
Well, get cracking.
Yeah, exactly. You know, some Venezuelan party politics in 1838, I'm dead meat.
That's what Google's for.
Exactly.
But if you, you know, we're always here to help, but you got to meet us halfway.
Oh, I get all kinds of funny things on Facebook. There was one person that asked if I could help her ID her stamp, and it was from, she had a, I want to say, how old is the PF?
1940-something. Something, yeah.
Okay, I want to say it was an old PF cert from the early 50s.
Okay.
And it didn't have a Scott number on it. And it was a stamp, the design that the number 9 comes from. It was imperforate, and the certificate said that it was either an essay or a proof of the 1851 issue, I think. That's my correction if I got that wrong. And it had a certain number in the top corner that was in the 5,000s. So she put that as the catalog number. She put, that's what the catalog number was. So I got that one. I get stuff from people where they say, can you help me? How much this stamp is worth? I can't find the price anywhere. And I ask them the Scott number, and they say A52. Okay, that's the design number. That can be a half a dozen different stamps. So, oh yeah, we get people, it's nice. People try to sound as educated as possible. When a picture sometimes is just better, I think.
Well, my two favorite, one of them called up and said, I have a 9-cent stamp from the Alamo. It has to be valuable. And I said, yeah, it was issued in 1954, and it's not. And the other person, it was very humorous because they said, I have a stamp from 1458 or something like that from Finland. And it was 1458 to 1958 commemorative. Hmm. And it had a picture of the Finnish, or it had a picture of an American flag on it. And I go, how can it be from 1458? I mean,
that's great.
You're from America. You should know that, you know.
No, they don't.
1776.
No, I have a feeling Scott wants to chime in with what we can ID by picture.
He's giving a look.
Well, can we identify grills from a picture?
No.
Okay. What about special easy. Printings?
No.
Okay.
How many 613s have we?
None.
So there's a caveat with a picture of a stamp. Not all stamps can be ID'd by a stamp.
We can point you in the right general direction.
But we
sometimes.
Can say that could be worth something or it could be worth 20 cents.
And generally, when you have something like that we cannot ID from just an image, those are the stamps that you want to put in front of a dealer or send to an expert service, although I would put it in front of a dealer first because generally the rarer stamps are, the less likely it is you have one. Although you can have one, it's more like winning the lottery sometimes. So
well, there was a.
So it's always best to get a extra pair of eyes on it first before you spend money to submit it for an expert certificate.
Or if you find them in a storage locker and you happen to be on TV, bring your camera crew over. You can borrow our room.
Yup.
That's a reference to everybody who hasn't seen the Storage Wars episode where we're on it.
Season 6, episode 19.
There you go.
They just posted a special link of that episode. Like a clip. So I'm going to put that up on the website instead of the link to the whole episode.
Yeah, there was somebody that sent me a message on Facebook a month or two ago. Discovered this guy, he must have spent 2 weeks crafting his English, getting it typed out just right. Because his replies, I almost offered to use Google Translate instead. He ended up being in Romania. Really nice guy, but he was
He was probably using Google Translate.
Oh, I'm sure. He was absolutely positive he had a real 596.
Mm-hmm. Oh, we talked about it already.
Yeah. So that guy, that was interesting. Finally tell him, no, that's not what it is. Leave me alone.
So we'll move on to the expert topic. which is number ones worldwide. And I listed some of the top number ones, but also what is the definition of a number one?
A number one is anything that in whatever catalog you're looking at. So we're in the United States, we use Scott Catalog. So if it is Scott's Catalog number one from fill in the blank of whatever country, it's a number one. So if it has a number one, and generally speaking, that doesn't include C1s or 1As or anything like that. It's got to have a one. It can.
Because you can define how you collect any way you want.
Yes, but number one collectors sort of have a certain guideline that they follow, whereas people who collect Hello
Sounds
Kitty
to me
on
like
stamps,
you're putting them into a box.
Yeah, putting them into a box.
I also like my first number one would be the first Hello Kitty versus the most of them are Japanese. So a Japanese number one would not have a Hello Kitty on it.
Yeah. Well, oh dear. Maybe like really it's got a dragon on it. And maybe down in the corner there's a little Hello Kitty looking up at the dragon.
There we go.
Hey, that could be some fun stamp
or
art.
Maybe Hello Kitty was the dragon's meal.
Ah, there you go.
Oh, it's in the dragon.
Hello Kitty is fighting its way out.
That's why you can't see her.
Ah.
So last week we talked about first day cancels. So when it comes to number ones, we're more interested in earliest uses, right?
Well, actually neither, but...
No, earliest uses are different. We talked about first day covers and first day cancels last week. Earliest known use kind of is generally for earlier stamps where either the official day isn't known or because it was so early, very few were used, and they may not have survived by now. So people try and get as close to that first day of issue as they can.
Yeah, if you collected first day cancels of number ones of the world, that would be a pretty impressive collection.
It'd also be a pretty expensive collection.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow. Is there even such a first thing as a first day cancel of like a U.S. number one?
No. They do not know of any first day uses of a U.S. number one at this time.
And that's where the term earliest known use comes from then.
Right.
Because they have the earliest known reference and that's it.
Right. Great Britain does have a first day cover of their number one, which is the first stamp. So that is astronomical money because...
Oh, that's got to belong to the Queen or something. It's got to be in her collection.
Yeah,
she has one.
Yeah.
Because I think there's more than one.
Oh, James. James Weigand was telling us about that. That he got to see Postal Museum in the UK and they have a sheet, a mint sheet of number ones. I think it was first plate. And he just sat, he said he sat there, his face just melted looking at these, just imagining the value.
Yep. Well, I personally collect number ones.
I suppose that would be easy to plate them then.
Mm. I would hope so.
plated examples are worth more than unplated examples.
Oh. So what kind of paper were they using for the earliest stamps?
Paper.
Paper.
Well,
paper. But hold on. Number ones of the world. You have some countries that just came into existence a while ago, and they have number ones. So you can have a number one from, what's a recent country that...
South Korea. That's
no, how about some Soviet...
How about...
USSR
like Ukraine. I don't think Ukraine. I think Ukraine doesn't start in...
How about Curacao?
Curacao. No, those are the older ones.
Curacao just became an independent
country. You're right. So
within the last couple of years.
Curacao, when it got its independence from the Netherlands.
It was part of the Dutch Antilles.
Right. And so now they will have a number one if they don't continue it on. You know, they could... sometimes they list a country and they keep going and then
it gets
its independence.
Yeah, sometimes they do.
Yeah, so... I don't know yet whether Curacao is going to have a number one or not, but I'm thinking like I believe the Ukraine didn't have stamps
or
until
Kosovo.
Kosovo, there's a good one. Kosovo had number ones from Kosovo or from 1990, whatever.
Yeah, any of the newer stands left over from the Soviet Union, Kazakhstan, however you say it, places like that would have recent ones. They can come on just about anything then.
Well, the hitch is that during the Russian Revolution, this is kind of what made it tough to answer that question, because during the Russian Revolution, you had some of these places like Georgia and Armenia making stamps. So you'll have stamps issued in 1918, 1919, 1920, and then the next issue is 1997.
Oh, my gosh. That's a big jump.
Yeah, and there's a lot of the Russian countries that have that sort of thing.
Let's get specific then. What paper was the penny black made on?
Watermarked paper, sometimes blued.
Bluish paper?
Sometimes.
Is that rare?
Machine made or handmade?
I think everything until about the 1870s was pretty much all handmade, and then after that they started machine making it.
So is it like laid paper?
That's a type of paper, yeah. But not necessarily.
Laid paper is just really a process of making handmade paper.
Mm-hmm. There's laid, wove, all kinds of different ones. But so, it would have been handmade, at least for the stuff from the 1850s and 40s. So that's why that's a very broad question.
Oh, I just thought there could be some kind of...
Well, actually, it's an interesting question, because if you look at... you have to go back a little further, but how they made paper, she brings up a good point if you go back earlier, because like in the 1776, you know, you look at our Constitution and our Declaration of Independence, and they're yellowish and crummy looking. And then you look at British paper from the same period, where they've had high quality rag stock and stuff, and it's all white. So, you know, it's like side to side, you go, well, I can tell who, you know, who had the better paper quality, that's for sure.
So do they have value in general?
Number ones?
Yeah.
Number
some
ones.
Do, some don't.
Well, actually, I've seen that all number ones have more value than they would deserve if they were not number one. There's a higher demand for a stamp just because it's a number one. And it doesn't matter if it's from the Ionian Islands or whatever. Number ones have a certain panache to them that you don't get from number two. And the funny thing is there are several countries, and I believe France is one of them, but I'm not certain, where the number one stamp was not the first stamp issued. They put them in numerical order. So, like, they listed 1 cent, 2 cent, 5 cent, 10 cent, and 25 and 50. And the 20-cent stamp, I believe, was issued first. And then everything came after it. So number five is actually the first stamp. And please don't write me if it's number four instead of number five or number six. I don't want to do a correction on this because it's – but the first stamp is not necessarily the number one of the country. Well, but that's people want the number ones.
That's because a lot of times you have a set and they just put the lowest denomination as the number one.
Like they did with U.S. airmails.
Yeah, yes. You stole the words out of my mouth.
Oh, sorry. Say that. Take that back. Jeff. Do you have anything to add?
Well, if you look at the U.S. airmail.
Oh, no. So what about Canada? They had a, I believe it was a beaver on their first stamp.
Mm-hmm. But then they had provinces before that. So you have the first stamp of Canada, and then you have the first stamp of Nova Scotia, the first stamp of Prince Edward Islands. And
I think we touched on it when we had Stanley Piller on, that the U.S., the first U.S. stamp with the catalog number one was not actually what is number one today. It was actually the New York Postmaster's Provisional was listed as number one, which is now today 9X1 in the early catalogs. So that can change as well as editorial changes are made to a catalog.
So it can be a matter of opinion, and in Stanley's case, he is incredibly opinionated. So the U.S. number one to this by the Scott catalog is not the U.S. number one as far as he's concerned.
Get well soon, Stanley.
Yes, get well soon. Yeah, the other thing is I was talking about the Colombia and Bolivia and the South American countries with provinces. And you may have a country that has 20 number ones in it. The number one for the country and the number one for every province from it. So, you know, some of these have huge numbers of number one stamps.
China's like that. Isn't it some of the early China because of all the provinces that they had?
Yes.
So I know China does that too, and it makes it a pain because a lot of theirs is overprint based.
Mm-hmm.
So that makes it fun. It's going to look the same. If you don't speak Mandarin, you can't read it. You're going to be forever. I've tried, believe me.
Well, that and some other really neat number ones, like for treaty ports and stuff, are worth more used than mint.
And, I mean, value is relative. I picked up a U.S. number one for $40 because it had a half-centimeter tear in it that had been very well repaired. And it's a good-looking stamp, but it's got a tear in it, so it's not worth as much. But you get mint unused of that stamp, well-centered, and pow, go through the roof.
So what advice can you give collectors of number ones?
You can probably complete 90% of your collection without spending serious money.
Define serious money.
A couple bucks per stamp.
Okay, then.
Oh, that's good.
Wow, that's...
Well, like I said...
I wouldn't have thought that.
Like we were talking about, that's because the number one is generally the... has the lowest face denomination if it's part of a set. So therefore...
Well, also, you know, everything isn't...
It may not
Great Britain number one. You've got, you know, Colombian and or Peru. You know, you have these provinces that the first stamp is, you know, 25 cents.
Yes, there are a lot of
Costa Rica, you know, Nicaragua. Well, not Nicaragua. I think they're more, but, you know, British Honduras, stuff like this. You can pick up probably 100 number ones before, you know, and find them in the discount piles.
Yeah, you know what? That's true. I found a lot of old stamps from South America in nickel bins.
Yeah.
Just because there's no demand for them, they're not worth a whole lot.
Yep. I paid $11 for my Puerto Rican number one. Okay, are we ready for the unveiling of the hopefully inverted Jenny sheet?
Oh, before we do that, though, do you want to mention the circus sheet that we heard about?
Oh, breaking news on Lynn's Twitter feed. There's a new, what do you want to call it, variety or printing error discovered of the circus sheet. Gold omitted.
Yeah, gold
omitted. And guess who has it? Mystic.
Where's that wah-wah-wah button?
So,
exactly.
Call them if you want it.
Okay, so inverted Jenny, here we come. And I have a good feeling about this one.
I have a good feeling that it's going to be an inverted Jenny sheet.
Me too. It is $12 in postage. Aww. Normal.
Yay! What are you going to do if you find one someday knowing it was just sitting in a box lid in your office for 6 months?
We record this so that when we do open one, we have all the yelling and screaming on on microphone.
There you go. Okay, you can email us at stampshowhereToday@gmail.com, Twitter at stampshowht, Facebook stampshowhereToday, and our website www.stampshowhereToday.com with your questions and comments. You can now leave your questions and comments on our Google Voice answering machine anytime. It's an answering machine nobody will pick up. Country code 1-949-873-4298. There's also a link to our Google Voice on our website so you can make a call from your computer. And on that note, keep collecting.
This is Gregory Slaughter from Esper, and I'm listening to the Stamp Show Here Today.
This episode of Stamp Show Here Today is brought to you by the Philatelic Book of Secrets, the book that teaches you about repurfs, regums, color varieties, and much more. Get yours for $10 at www.philatelicsecrets.com today.